And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Take one of America's premier foundations, mix in a festival to celebrate the centennial of one of America's greatest national parks, then sprinkle lightly with a touch of folly, and what do you get? Today's show, Fools, Foundations, and Festivals, coming right up when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're approaching one of America's favorite weekends. It's time to go on Daylight Savings Time. Quite a week of contrasts, as in parts of the planet, people had the sun stolen by a total eclipse. While here now, we await that magic moment always on a Sunday evening, when it's like a gift. The sun just keeps on shining when the day before it was dark. It's a sign of better times ahead, and Lord knows we need some better days. It's been a tough spell around the planet, not so much from the weather as it has been from trying to determine which way the wind is blowing. The Great War on Terror isn't so great anymore. And I'll stop right there politically, as quite frankly, we've got a lot of good show coming up, and it's time to tell you what's coming. Fools, Foundations, and Festivals. That's what's coming. In segment 3, we talk with Billy Parrish, who is right in the thick of college issues. As Time Magazine provides a special edition on global warming with the headline, Be Worried, Be Very Worried, it's good to know what's happening on campuses these days. For our Foundations segment, which follows the news, we'll be talking with the new executive director of the ubiquitous Surfrider Foundation about what they do and where the tides are taking them as they focus their mission on the waves and beaches where most people meet their oceans. And in segment 2, our festival segment, we talk with Dan Pushkar about the 100th anniversary of one of America's greatest cultural meccas, Mesa Verde National Park. So we get this springtime extravaganza rolling as soon as we hear what's up with this week's Earth News. So first, the news. This week's Wild Side News quote of the week. Bottom trawling is like trying to capture songbirds in a forest with bulldozers. This was the wisdom of Arlo Hemphill, Conservation International's Manager of Marine Strategy, commenting on the upside of a requested moratorium on deep-sea trawling, issued by the European Union during a UN-sponsored environmental conference in Brazil. At the same event, the island nation of Kiribati announced the creation of a vast protected area around the Phoenix Islands, located halfway between Fiji and Hawaii. Kiribati's president, Anote Tong, added his wisdom as well with, "If the coral and reefs are protected, then the fish will thrive and grow and bring us benefit." Whether or not the rest of the conference will ratify the ban on bottom trawling is yet to be determined. Environmentalists praise the two moves as indicative of a growing trend toward protecting the world's oceans. In a somewhat related move, that up again, down again, up again bill to allow oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, well, Republican leader John Bonner thinks it will have a tough time being approved when voted on as part of the budget bill. Following the Senate's inclusion of granting leases for drilling in their budget bill, which was passed by the Senate, 24 House Republicans announced that they could not support a budget bill that approved drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge. Instead, they are planning to introduce legislation to help America kickstart improved hopes for energy independence within the next 10 years. And the California congressman, who never seemed to be able to find an environmental protection law he could not aggressively oppose, finds himself in a tough race for re-election. Yes, Representative Richard Pombo, the poster child of environmental indifference, who wears his cowboy hat and boots to give him that tough guy look, is appearing now in ads and in person, sans hat and boots, and trying to appear like more of an environmentalist to better match his changing constituency. Amazingly, even Republicans are working for his departure from the sacred halls of Congress. His most ardent opponent is none other than moderate Republican Pete McCloskey, who moved into Pombo's district specifically to challenge him for the seat. McCloskey, who was one of the authors of the Endangered Species Act, moved into the district after failing to enlist an effective Republican contender to unseat Pombo. Of course, Pombo's loyal opponents are happy to see such challenges. Roger Schleicheson, president of Defenders of Wildlife, shared the sentiments of McCloskey as he stated recently, "Getting rid of him would be the best thing politically that could happen to us in the November election." Pombo's troubles are not limited to his questionable environmental ethics. He also suffers from just plain ethics, as he has been implicated as one of the lawmakers who was taking money from Jack Abramoff, the high-powered lobbyist who was just sentenced to over 5 years in prison for just one of his illegal schemes. With so much bad news on the environmental front, it's always refreshing to hear that occasional feel-good story. And that's the news. And a few announcements. Global warming. A month back, the Wildside News had as its lead story, "Global warming, it's real." Well, apparently that idea is gaining some great allies as this week, the Ad Council, Environmental Defense, and Ogilvy & Mather, one of the world's leading advertising agencies, teamed up to produce and distribute on mainstream media a series of PSAs about global warming. And it sure makes a difference when the really big media people get involved. I'll be playing one audio spot between each segment produced by this coalition to give you a sense of how our message is now being promoted by the majors. And I also have links to the TV spots on today's show page. I guarantee you, you will be impressed when you see how the threat of global warming is handled. It's encouraging to see these issues finally breaking through the ice of the mainstream media. It's good to have them working with us directly for a change. Thanks. Our first feature was conducted via a cell phone while the guest was driving back up from Tijuana, so bear with me a bit on the sound. Seems everyone has heard of the Surf Rider Foundation at some time or another. It's a truly romantic moniker for a global endeavor to focus on that area where the land and the oceans collide, known as the surf. There's a huge community of people who head out in the mornings early and head out to the coasts, actually all over the world, to try to catch the big wave and take it for a ride to wherever it goes. They're known as the surfers, and historically, they're a rather free-form group of people. They span the spectrum from young to very old. And a number of years ago, they began to organize for a whole lot of reasons. One, because they were losing their places to surf. And out of that grew an organization called SurfRider.org. Joining us now is the new executive director of SurfRider.org, the Surf Rider Foundation, Jim Moriarty. Jim, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about Surf Rider Foundation and how it began.
Great story. There's actually a story before the beginning of the guys that started it were doing some Baja relief to some people down there that needed relief, so they brought clothes and all different kinds of things down to people in Baja. But where they really started to organize and what later became the Surf Rider Foundation was the fact that they all lived in and around Malibu. And one day there was literally a bulldozer changing the river foundation coming out to the coast at First Point Malibu, which is among the most classic surf spots in the world. It's featured in, you know, a whole lot of very corny movies. And there's a bulldozer literally ruining the beach, and three people, it's the classic story that three people just, you know, thought this is not acceptable. They're going to ruin, you know, a resource here that we view as incredibly important and very valuable to us. And they not only thought that, but then they put their thoughts into actions and they started to interact with the city councils and all the right people and change the course of Malibu. And to this day, you know, their work at First Point Malibu stands. So that from that point on, Surf Rider Foundation essentially became a group of coastal enthusiasts. So it's not necessarily surfers. It's people that live in and around the coast that essentially value that and act on that thought and on those needs. We're kind of emissaries or advocates for coastal resources.
Right. You've expanded out now, and you're very active in a whole series of actions and concerns all over the world now. As a matter of fact, I think you have, what, 50,000 members. Why don't you tell me about your membership?
The membership in the United States is around 52,000. It's doubled in probably the last 5-6 years. One of the most interesting aspects of our membership, though, that I've found is the fact that people internationally essentially steal or take our logo and start their own Surfrider foundations everywhere without our permission. So we now today have representation, legal affiliates in Australia, Brazil, Japan, and Europe, and every single one of those started without our permission. There's a great compliment in that, you know, that people essentially see your idea as something that maybe is similar to freedom or something that transfers regions. It's not a Southern California phenomenon. It's an issue everywhere all over the world. The people essentially live along the coast, and they say, okay, we need to protect this. It's a great asset. It's a great part of our lives.
That's a great story. I wasn't aware of that. People just kind of adopt you.
Yeah, and we actually, it got so out of hand that 7 years ago we put a moratorium on international expansion because we just didn't have the manpower or staffing or funding to manage that. And this year, for the first time, matter of fact, in the last probably 5 months, we lifted the moratorium, and we've also just in the last 30 days hired our first international staffer to manage that. And this year we expect to have 6 international chapters pop up in Argentina, 2 in Costa Rica, 2 in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, define what the mission is. It really embraces a whole spectrum of sustainability and a healthy planet.
The mission is probably the lightning rod that everyone around Surfrider agrees on. And from, you know, as you get further into details, people start to disagree on different things. But it can really be brought down to a very small number of words. And it's essentially protecting ocean waves and beaches. And the real emphasis on it is really protecting waves and beaches. And there's a couple of reasons for, you know, why I've distilled it down to those words. First of all, we're not really an ocean group. We're not a deep blue group like Ocean Conservancy and other groups. And we're also not a green group like Sierra Club, meaning that we don't deal inland very far. We really try to stay as much as we can right along the coast. That's really our sweet spot. So as an example, we do get involved in things like seawalls. We get involved in things like artificial reefs. We get involved in water quality. Today's a perfect example. I was supposed to go down and tour the Tijuana watershed with Wild Coast, and it's been raining all night and raining all day, and you know, I basically just made the decision that the Tijuana watershed is in such bad shape that even a tour during the rain, after a couple of days of rain, is just going to be horrible.
Yes, it would be.
So, but that's the kind of issue that we would get involved in.
Mm-hmm. You're also trying to protect the access to the oceans for the populace in general.
Absolutely. Yeah, we view, you know, and this is, as I said, some people have different views, and this is one of those issues where some people have different views on this. You know, I believe the statistic is that the coast of Maine, 40% of the coast of Maine is inaccessible. And on the West Coast here in California, pretty much most of California, and most of the West Coast, you can access. You can, I mean, just the idea of going to the beach, you can just go to the beach. You can park. You really don't have to pay for parking. There's certain places that you have to pay for, like, preferred access. But you can just access the beach, but that's not the case on the East Coast. I've been to meetings where kids have been arrested. Like, when I say kids, I mean, like 10 or 11-year-olds have been written up for multi-hundred-dollar tickets and fines because they literally paddled into waves in front of private clubs on Long Island. So
wow.
They didn't even walk on the sand. they were in the ocean, and so they're receiving, you know, large tickets.
A sense of ownership out a distance away from the shoreline.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. So as an example, we had a recent victory in Rockaway Beach, which is again on Long Island, and it was a law from the 1850s where no one paid attention to it until a new mayor came in and decided that he needed more revenue sources and read the laws that existed. And there was one from the 1850s that essentially talked about accessing the beach with flotation devices. This was well before there was any surfing in the area. And the mayor started, you know, writing out, again, very high fines for people that were just walking around with boogie boards and surfboards and other things, and even just walking on the beach. And so we fought that and overturned it. And so we do believe very strongly that people should just be able to access the beach.
I think that's just such a powerful thing. It's something we take for granted here in California.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily powerful in terms of what it adds to our life. You also are working on larger global issues. I mean, we're talking about global warming now. We're talking about coastal pollution. You're very active in those realms. Many of your members are active in monitoring water quality at the coasts.
Yeah, about, I don't know when it started, maybe 10 years ago, we had the idea of starting a volunteer grassroots water quality network. So we did that, and it's today you can access it at rashguard.org. But we're actually in the process of taking a step back, and internally we're assessing how important that is and where the data can come from. So right now we're actually talking with there's about a dozen academic leaders dealing with coastal water quality as part of their life's work. And we've engaged the majority of them now, and we are contemplating a nationwide and then worldwide water quality network, which would have kind of an optimized algorithm, which would take inputs from municipal testing, from volunteer testing, from all different types of local precipitation impacts, topographical, tidal, surges, sun, and essentially coming up with an algorithm that we would almost take water quality away from what it is today, which is essentially letting people know how bad it was yesterday.
Mm.
There's really nowhere in the world that can tell you how bad it is right now. Real-time water quality monitoring for a lot of the bacteria just does not exist. But we're going to be working with a lot of academic institutions to be on the front end of the hardware to do that, but then also to take it from how bad it was yesterday to how bad it is right now, and even to the point of forecasting water pollution and water quality levels and how it will be tomorrow.
That is very progressive.
This is one of those surfer angles that, you know, the surfers are the canaries in the coal mine. We are literally out there duck diving underwater, and then, you know, you fast forward a year later and somebody's getting their lymph nodes removed, and it's not fun.
Yeah, that's for sure. I'm going to kind of switch the discussion here a little bit because you're the new executive director. You've been
right
with them, with Surf Riders, since about 6 months, is it?
You know, it's about eight, but
8 months?
6-8 is probably not that different.
Close enough. Some people would say that you don't fit the normal sort of quote-unquote, and as you said, you're not necessarily an environmental group, but people consider you part of the environmental organizations. But you have a unique background. First of all, you weren't born on the coast. Secondly, you come from a corporate background. Third, I believe it's no secret that you consider yourself a Republican, and all of that's just fine. But I think that's exciting, actually. Where's the crossover here between that sort of background and your mission now, personally, and then for surfrider.org?
Yeah, I think it's a logical question. And it's one that I actually had myself as I started interacting with the board. The first couple of times I talked to them, I literally told them that I'm not their man. I literally said that I'm not, you know, a policy wonk. I'm not a person who, you know, volunteers his time in this specific kind of area. I volunteer my time, you know, mentoring high school students and things like that. But what I learned through the process, through the interview process was that they were really looking for was someone who could take the values and the brand of coastal stewardship and environmental protection and bring it into the 21st, which is absolutely where I live. I mean, for the last 20 years, I've been building and working alongside some of the most brilliant minds in technology, taking kind of the world is flat thinking and applying it to the coastal environment and then marrying that with my own personal love of action sports and board sports, makes a lot of sense once you get closer to it.
So how do you hope to transform and advance the Surfrider Foundation's mission, bringing your skills to the challenge?
Well, one of the things that you mentioned was the Republican angle, and I'm always intrigued that people pick up on that, because to me it doesn't matter. I think so many times we try to oversimplify and look at the world with binary eyes. Oh, that's a Republican issue. Oh, that's a Democrat issue. There's no such thing as a pro-life Democrat. Well, of course there are. You know, many of my friends are pro-life Democrats. And from my perspective, one of the ways that Surfrider needs to succeed, regardless of being right, we need to succeed. The way that we need to succeed is with what I'm calling a Big Tent approach. I don't care if you surf. I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat. I don't care if you're 10 years old or 100 years old. We can't have these kind of filters on people that we let into a movement that says, let's protect the coast. So it doesn't matter to me what someone's religious affiliation is or their political affiliation. I'm looking for people that value what's happening at the coast and will act on that, on those instincts and on those interests. So as you look at the people that make up the Surfrider Foundation, we did a very unscientific, quick snapshot during the last political election. It was 50-50, 50% Republican, 50% Democrat. That, to me, makes total sense. So to answer your question, one way that I'm going to impact the organization is to promote a Big Ten approach and to really reach out across political spectrum, across all the various self-imposed filters, and tell everyone that lives along the coast, you need to get involved and protect this, or it will be gone. Secondly, I referenced earlier in the book, The World is Flat. I mean, the world is flat. You know, you pick up the phone and you change your cell phone provider and you're talking to someone in Argentina or Bangalore. That's just life. It's not something that is either right or wrong. It just is. So my mentality is a little bit, the world is flat. Get over with it. Deal with it. And from my perspective, you need to take a step back and say, in our world of blogs and 24-hour media and wireless access and dead zones the size of Rhode Island off the coast of Louisiana, you know, in the world that we live in today with all the various issues, how can we make an impact on the coast? And from my perspective, one of the ways we need to do that is treat the intelligence that we can access as an asset. If you look at Google, Google isn't a technology company. They're a company that is all about delivering access to information. And to some degree, we are a similar thing. We need to have people in Chile who are dealing with gross polluting paper mills be able to go onto whatever search engine or whatever internet access they have and be able to find information on how they can organize and what the issues are without ever picking up the phone and talking to us, because we're not probably going to answer the phone and talk to them. We just don't have the staff. We'll never have the staff to talk to people in Indonesia, but we do have the ability to put intelligence out there in the form of case studies, and we can translate into different languages. We can do a lot of different things that scale in a non-traditional environmental organization way. And so the way that I'm going to have an impact on this organization is I'm really going to bring it from, in my opinion, from the last century to this century by embracing tools like the one that you're using right now. I mean, I do a radio interview on other radio shows, and people have to be listening to the radio live. And on your show, it can essentially be accessed, I'm guessing, anytime, and podcasting and things like that. So this is a perfect example of it.
It's magic. It serves us so well. We need to embrace this and utilize it, and it's so easy. The interesting thing is that it's so doable, and I appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit personally here, because it really does, there is this relationship that we have with the oceans, with the waves, and it is very personal. Talk to me, because I think that's also where there is this crossover, where it doesn't matter who you are, what your background is, there is this human connection with nature, and the oceans have a very special place for many, many people. When they come there, something happens.
Right.
From your perspective, and all these people that you're working with and talking with, give us a sense of what you think is the basis of that personal connection.
Well, during the interview process, I was asked the question, are you an environmentalist? And I said, every surfer is an environmentalist. And we got into a discussion on that. And essentially there was a thought process that not every surfer is an environmentalist. And I said, you know, from my perspective, anyone who goes to the beach has to be impacted at some level at the beach. It's just like if you go into Yosemite, you're impacted by what you see in some way. In my opinion, the deeper you go into the environment, the more you're impacted by it, or the more that you have the potential to be impacted by it. I was talking to Yvonne Chouinard, founder of Patagonia, about this, and you know, the deeper that they went into Yosemite in the early days of rock climbing, when they were smashing the rocks with pitons, they understood, okay, we're ruining the environment that we love. And so the mountaineering and alpinists literally transferred from that kind of sport to something that is incredibly environmental because they're impacted by it. In my opinion, the people that, you know, divers or snorkelers or people that are literally submerged in the elements along the ocean, surfers and boogie boarders and body surfers, those people understand that the environment, the fragility of the environment, because they see a dolphin go by, they see, you know, sea lions, they step on, you know, rays. It's different than if you're in a boat, you know, a fishing boat or something, and you're just looking down at it all. You're literally in it. So in my opinion, there is a very, very deep connection that surfers and other people that are literally in the ocean have with the environment. And it's actually really hard for me to understand how someone wouldn't be impacted by that.
Mm-hmm. As you're talking now to a broad spectrum of people literally around the world, what are things that they should be aware of and thinking about as it relates to the waves and the beaches?
I think in the end it comes down to just almost an appreciation for the natural forces at work and for keeping them that way. So essentially, if you build a house too close to the beach, it will be taken down over time by the ocean. If you build a wall, the same thing. And when you try to kind of add your own footprint into nature's footprint, you're essentially going to lose eventually. And it kind of goes back to, you know, 2,000 years, the Bible was written about, you know, the wise man built his house upon the rock. And still, here we are in 2006, and in Fulana Beach, my hometown, people are building their house upon the sand, and the walls are coming tumbling down. I mean, it's just happening. I think simple things like that, just the knowledge of, okay, these waves, you know, rise, it's like the tsunamis or the floods and Katrina and all those other things. Nature has a cyclical force, and that force is very, very strong. So as you look at places like Europe and the coast of Europe where they have zones that you cannot build houses close to the coast, I mean, that's just kind of logical sense. I think the other thing that makes a lot of sense is you're down in Central America and other places is just the simple, simple need to take measures to contain your trash. I mean, with the advent and explosion of plastic, if you throw the plastic into the river or into the coast, you're going to be causing damage eventually. And A, if you see those kinds of things, you just pick them up. But B, you should kind of work to figure out a solution so that doesn't happen.
Very good. Jim, for people who want to learn more about Surf Rider Foundation, what's the best way to do so?
Go to surfrider.org, and I would encourage you to actually find your local chapter. If you live near the coast, anywhere in the United States and increasingly around the world, there's usually a group of people that are pretty like-minded. And they're not, you know, Jeff Spicoli surfers. They're soccer moms, they're kids, they're seniors. They cross all the political spectrum. And that's one of the most encouraging things that I've seen as I've traveled to most of the chapters in our United States. We have 64 chapters. Surf Rider is you. Surf Rider is basically people that live at the coast. And I would rather people actually get engaged and with their local chapter than even join the national organization. But that said, we'd love for you to join, and you can go to surfrider.org and join our organization.
Jim Moriarty, new Executive Director of Surf Rider Foundation, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Thanks so much.
From the surf of sunny California, we're heading up to the high mesas of Colorado to one of America's premier cultural meccas known as Mesa Verde. There's a big celebration occurring this year, and you'll learn more about that and more when your voice of the earth returns, here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.